This is Monocle on Design, Monocle's weekly show dedicated to the best in architecture, industrial design, graphics and fashion. I'm Josh Fennett. Coming up today...
The cover doesn't want to reveal everything all at once. It wants to intrigue you and just say enough about what's inside.
Should you judge a book by its cover? We stock up on some reading material and ask our favourite designers what makes a book cover fly off the shelves, and if the digital deluge has hampered the enduring charm of a good read. Plus, a look at the design headlines from around the world and an interview with the design director of furniture firm Knoll. That's the latest instalment of our office furniture series on how we work. All that coming up right here on Monocle on Design on Monocle 24 with me, Josh Fennett. Do stay tuned. We're often told not to judge a book by its cover, but that might not always be good advice, or so I'm told by Monocle's culture editor, Chiara Rumella, who joins me in studio now. And I'll let the listeners in on a secret. Most of my ideas from the show come from the fine work in Monocle magazine, of which you're the culture editor. And our little chat here about the world of book covers is premised on a wonderful story that you commissioned, Chiara. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yes, so it's a story that ran in the May issue of the magazine, and I've got to come clean. I honestly do judge a book by its cover, and probably not the best thing for me to admit as a culture editor. I do read the book inside, I promise, as well. But I think there's something really fascinating about going to a bookshop like Dawn's that we have just round the corner and just letting yourself be guided by what the designers decided to make of the book. Because ultimately, I think a book designer is a bit of a hybrid designer in that they're not really, well, no designer is really ever only concerned with form. But in this case, a lot of the times they will read the book and they will interpret it in a way that I think is very interesting because it kind of is tantalizing, but it's not meant to be as explicative as perhaps a lot of other design needs to be.
We've got a number of books to talk through, some with beautiful covers, some looking a little bit page-worn. But first of all, we're going to hear from one of the interviewees in the show. We spoke to London-based graphic designer Sonia Jakova, who has developed book covers and jackets for everything from a fermentation-focused cookbook for the restaurant Noma to a photography book for the American filmmaker David Lynch. Here's what she had to say.
You asked what makes a good cover. I think it's a bit like when you go to a party and you meet an interesting person. You don't want that person to tell you everything about their life straight away because that would be really odd and it's too much information. So just like that, the cover doesn't want to reveal everything all at once. It wants to intrigue you and just say enough about what's inside. One of the things that we always are drawn to is tactility in the digital age where everything is sort of flat and we want to touch things. For example, we worked on a book for David Lynch. It's a book of nudes that he has photographed all these beautiful series of black and white and color female nudes. And again, here I can summarize the concept in a few sentences, really. It's all women and in a way, he's worshipping women. And we asked ourselves, what is so special about a woman? And I suppose the thing that came to mind is a woman can be fruitful and can multiply. So we juxtaposed two images, one on the cover itself and the other one on a transparent jacket. Mm-hmm. And when you put them together, you get a third image. Beautiful close-ups of legs and knees crisscrossing each other, and on the back it's also another image, two images creating a third. And it's really something that at first you wouldn't realize, but you just like it for its qualities. And the other thing is David Lynch's practice and films, they're quite dark and disturbing quite often, and that's his signature. So we thought it was nice to use a very strange and contrasting materials, like the cover is very glossy film, but it's sitting on a jacket that's quite hairy. Mm-hmm. It's a very tactile Japanese paper that has a lot of fiber in it. So when you touch it, it's quite strange to touch. What's attractive to me is inventive binding techniques, printing techniques that I haven't possibly seen before, or combinations of materials that are put together in an interesting way. I think we always view a book as an object. So we all know what a typical book looks like, but how can a book surprise you? And I think quite often it is through physical way that it's been put together, what paper is used, how does it feel in your hands. We all sort of fall into familiar roots, and that's just the way that the mind works. You know, you sort of tend to do things that you're familiar with and your brain is comfortable with it, so therefore you keep doing it again and again. But the point of our job is to find new solutions and new ways. And I often will catch myself saying, well, that looks really nice, and then thinking, why do I like that? Is it because it's familiar and it's pleasing to the eye? And should I try harder to do something that's sort of more inventive or unusual or unexpected? I try to surprise myself.
Sonia Jakova of Atelier Jakova speaking to us there recently. Now, Chiara Rumella, Monocle's culture editor, is still in the studio with a bit of a reading list for us. Tell us about some of these books that we have in front of us.
Yes, so I brought a varied selection, which I think is useful in order to understand how book covers don't necessarily need to be beautiful or the most shouty in order to be effective. I think what I found out with commissioning this story is that the book needs to conceal as well as reveal. It's not just information design that you're doing. So I've brought three examples of three books that use three different kinds of covers to bring you in. One of them is Cathedral by Raymond Carver. One of them is Mothers by Chris Power. And one of them is Sunshine State by Sarah Gerrard. Now, what these different covers do is they use photography, painting and illustration in a way to show that there are so many ways that you can go about doing a book cover. And sometimes it's really not about designing very much, but about choosing the right image and letting that do all the work. In Cathedral, for example, we've got this ominous kind of dusky shot of a suburban American house with only the one window lit. And that's just so evocative of the sense of loneliness and kind of ominousness that these stories do. It does nothing other than just telling you the name of the author, in this case, bigger than the name of the title, which says a lot about what sells.
Interesting.
On this cover. Yeah. It's the name of the author. Whilst if we move to Mothers, it's just a painting. And the painting is a painting of a woman whose face has been erased by some white paint. The title is bigger than the name of the author because obviously it's more attractive. And the title is Mothers. And obviously the painting represents a woman with no face. Again, giving you a very clear idea that this is not going to be a lovey account of a family.
It's very disturbing. I mean, and I always think about this idea of omission as well as addition. The idea of omitting someone's face and having the title as Mothers is very eerie, isn't it? It creates a sense of kind of unrest with this kind of very familiar notion that we all have. And like you said, I just want to talk very briefly about illustration. Book cover design is one of those wonderful places where people are still commissioning great illustration. Obviously, we commission a lot for the magazine, but I think the overall trend is down and towards digital, which brings me on to another point. 5 or 6 years ago, we were decrying the loss of bookshops. We were saying that paper was a bad way of reading. We've kind of come round to the idea that it's a two-way street, haven't we? Not so many Kindles about and quite a lot of good books.
No, definitely. And I think illustration, again, is a very powerful signifier of, as you say, somebody's taken the initiative to commission somebody to make that specifically for the book. It's a signifier of quality, and it signifies the quality of the inside of the book as well. It means that it's a literary title more often than not. A lot of the times, if you look at very commercial titles, they will have stock photography, very loud typography. Illustration is a subtler way of signifying, I've taken my time over this.
And is there such thing as a perfect book cover? I'm thinking of very simple ideas like the Fitzcarraldo editions, which obviously have just a colour-coded system. I think it's blue for fiction, white for non-fiction. They reverse the colour of the font in either case, and they all look exactly the same. What do you think of those kind of ideas, or is it all about variation and experimenting?
It's a tricky thing, series are. I've got here a book by Adelphi, who are an Italian publisher, very much like Fitzcarraldo. They just do one series, just changed the colour of the cover, but they just got their own publisher's symbol, and that's it. In this case, you really just rest completely on the authority of your own publishing house. And that's what comes to the forefront. And then the only point of difference is just the name of the title itself. You need to be a very knowing reader to be pulled into that. An example of an excellent series, I think, is Great Ideas by Penguin Books. These are designs by David Pearson, who I believe you have spoken to as well, and who we've spoken to as part of our story as well. These are plays on what we already know about typography. These are plays on what we already know about the books. Just kind of using subtle hints at making everything a little bit different, but ultimately very consistent. They're just a wonderful thing. And he's, I think, one of the most interesting book designers that are around nowadays.
We did speak to David Pearson. He studied at Central St Martins, where he says he fell into book design. He worked for Penguin and then set up his studio, Type as Image, in 2007. His work includes covers for authors including Cormac McCarthy, Noam Chomsky and John le Carré. He spoke about the importance of tactility and why physical books are more important than ever.
I insist quite heavily on working with typography and typography alone, and I've even renamed my company Type as Image to try and suggest to clients what I might be giving them. It's quite helpful because I think I can't paint, I can't draw, I get scared about cropping photographs, but with Type I'm much more confident and using it in an expressive way in particular. I love editorial design in particular, but magazine design's too quick for me, so book design, it syncs up with the rhythm that I work at, and it enables me to pore over details, to take my time, just to feel comfortable about what I'm doing. Every book cover, I think, should match or try to match the tone and the temper of the writing, and I think really there's not much more to be done. I was in the Penguin Archive, which is so unique in that it has two copies of every book they've ever produced, but crucially, they're laid out in chronological order. So you can walk along a shelf and see what visual tropes were popular and for how long, you know, judged on how many metres you're walking past them. You'll get these tiny moments where a colour preference will come in and it will disappear. A photographic style will announce itself, and then you walk beyond it. And it's such an interesting way to assess the history of design on book covers. If you have two books within the same series, you can create them differently, knowing that they'll be on a shelf next to one another, and they will create a spark. We have conspicuous consumption, and we have the myth of Sisyphus. And one is a very decorative pattern cover, very floral, and that sort of allows you then to create an incredibly brutal, modern-looking cover. And you know, when they're next to one another, they spark, and you know, they create a sort of frisson. And I find that very interesting. When people are looking at multiples, how do you keep them looking? And I think these kind of gear changes can really help with that, with the myth of Sisyphus. You know, the big black square is the boulder. So you're hopefully opening that door a little bit for people to interpret. And again, it's just that slight miscommunication where you're opening door and you're allowing people in to figure that out. It's not for everyone, and you can really annoy people by doing this, but I think there's a sweet spot where people enjoy wrestling with what they're looking at.
David Pearson there. His studio is Type as Image and based here in London. He spoke recently to this show's producer, Daphne Karnesis. Stay with us as we cover a few more design stories on our radar this week. And I'm delighted to welcome back to the studio design journalist Katie Tregidden. Katie, you're a little bit exhausted, I imagine, not from the way you look, but from what you told me before we came on air, because last week you were running around at Clerkenwell Design Week, and lots going on in the design news. You're here to give us a bit of a digest, is that right?
Yes, absolutely.
So the first story I'd like to talk about also is something from last week, but is a brilliant topic. I'm so glad you suggested it. The EU elections, being fought rather controversially here in the UK because some people might have imagined that we would have left at this point.
Yes.
But branding has its place at the ballot box as well, and you wanted to talk about some of the party logos.
Yeah, well, I think it's really interesting that people sometimes imagine that design sort of sits in a box and is separate from the rest of the world, but actually it's manifest in everything that humans produce.
Sits in a ballot box.
It does sit in a ballot box, and in some cases points an arrow to one of the boxes on a ballot box, controversially.
So you're talking there about the Brexit Party logo, which... by all accounts, it's a very clever logo.
Yeah, I mean, it's been sort of highly praised, in inverted commas, by Ben Terrett, who was the award-winning designer of gov.co.uk. And I think highly praised in its cleverness, but, you know, he's a Remainer, so I think he's nervous about that cleverness. Essentially, it's been defended as a house on its side, but a house on its side is an arrow. And the logo is essentially a big fat arrow that says Brexit and points to the box you need to put a cross in. And anybody who understands nudge theory will understand that, you know, it's very easy to influence behaviours by gentle suggestions. So a big arrow pointing to a box is potentially an unfair advantage on a ballot paper.
And if we leave our political predilections at the door, could we not just praise this as a good piece of design, as a persuasive thing like the hidden arrow in the FedEx logo that people love to discover and rediscover? Is this not just a good piece of graphic design?
Yeah, it's a brilliant piece of graphic design, absolutely, undoubtedly. Whoever designed it has done a very good job. I think that the problem is whether it's in breach of legislation of what's allowed on a ballot paper. And certainly Richard Bentall, who is Professor of Clinical Psychology at Sheffield University, has complained to the Electoral Commission because he believes that the design of the logo is in breach of the legislation around what's allowed on a ballot paper.
How interesting. And we'll just talk about one bad logo, will we? The Change UK party, a splinter group which took members from both the Conservatives and Labour and across the political spectrum to talk about the exact opposite of the Brexit Party. They're in favour of a people's vote and a kind of broadly pro-Remain policy. They've kind of got like a set of prison bars on its side or a barcode or something.
Well, the current logo is almost like the menu on a website, what they call the hamburger logo. So on a website, it's usually three lines. Theirs is three horizontal stripes. Unfortunately, their previous logo, which was the letters TIG in a box and hashtag change underneath, was rejected for not being recognisable enough and because hashtag change leads to online content which the Electoral Commission didn't feel they could review and therefore couldn't decide whether or not that was allowed. And so they're actually going ahead without anything on the ballot paper. So when you looked at the ballot papers last week, there was no logo for Change UK. And I think that's just a really interesting example of people not understanding how important branding is. You know, their names changed a couple of times. They didn't get a logo together in time for the elections. And these things are hugely important when it comes to that decision in the voting booth.
I couldn't agree more. I think that's a brilliant first topic. We're getting a little bit more macabre for our second topic. My producer handed me a note that said death pod. I don't know if it was a threat. I don't know if it was in reference to this item. What are these death pods, Katie?
Well, Philip Nitschke has designed and produced a 3D printed death pod. The idea is that it is a completely sealed coffin-like pod. Somebody who has made the decision to die can climb inside it, press a button, it will fill with liquid nitrogen. They will feel slightly tipsy and die a peaceful, quick death. There is an AI-powered mental capacity test to make sure that person is capable of making that decision in sound mind, that they're not drunk, they're sort of mentally capable to make that decision. And it can be moved around, so this could be placed overlooking the sea or in the Alps or in your family home. And then the pod is detached and can be used as a coffin, which will biodegrade. I mean, there is lots of problems around euthanasia itself, whether that should be allowed, whether AI is a good enough, you know, kind of device for determining mental capacity. But I think it's interesting because I think death is something we need to talk about. I think there are lots of ways that design can play a part in creating better deaths and better grieving processes for people. And I think it's something that historically media have been very nervous about covering.
Next on our packed agenda, we're going back to school a little bit, aren't we? And I suppose we're moving from the subject of death into life and specifically biodesign.
Yeah, Central St Martins has launched what it's billing the world's first master's degree in biodesign, which I think is a really interesting development. It's sort of come off the back of a lot of innovation they've done around what used to be their Textiles Futures and became their Materials Futures course. So they're very active in this area. But I think it's a really interesting example of a course which is equal parts art and science. And I think those two things have become quite separate and are starting to come back together. And I think that's a really interesting development.
How exciting. And we're going to end with a slightly bigger company. Nike.
So Nike have developed a new version of their Air Force One shoe with a molar pattern, which is a pattern that has been designed and developed over hundreds of years by the Guna people in Panama. And they sort of were about to launch it and have had to withdraw it because it seems they developed this pattern without consent, involvement, any sort of input from the Guna people who own that pattern. And they have sort of made an argument on the basis of intellectual property rights. So they've sort of said, look, we designed this, you can't just take it. But I think there's actually a bigger issue here, and that's of cultural appropriation. And that's something that I think is happening a lot in the design industry at the moment. There seems to be quite a lot of controversy and debate and argument around sort of people taking patterns and ideas from other cultures and then reusing them for commercial gain.
And where do you sit on this?
I think that's an interesting that you make that point. There's a difference between inspiration and appropriation, I think. And I think if you're, you know, if you're visiting a place and understanding something and being inspired by that and then creating something of your own and something new, then I think that's absolutely fine. I think the danger is when we appropriate things from a culture without really understanding them. So there's a big debate going on social media at the moment about the Western use of the words wabi-sabi and kintsugi. And I think that, you know, a similar thing happened with hygge, actually, when people are taking the bits they want from a culture without really understanding the deep meaning and the deep understanding and the cultural implications that go behind them. So the molar pattern is actually based on a handmade textile, which itself is based on a traditional body painting technique. And these patterns and traditions have been used to fight westernization. So they've been used to help the molar people very much hang on to their heritage and resist, you know, sort of people coming in and saying, no, look, you've got to wear these Western clothes and you've got to stop doing these practices. So then for a company like Nike to sort of slap them on their trainers and sell them to the world, it feels a little bit disrespectful to that heritage and that history. I think there's also a lovely little phrase which again appears on social media a lot, which is nothing about us without us. And this idea that actually if you want to engage with a culture and a people, talk to them, collaborate with them, get them involved, make sure that they're representing themselves rather than you just taking something from them and then using it without their involvement.
I suppose crucially as well, this isn't an exhibition, this isn't for the public good in any way, this is to sell a trainer. So
yeah.
I think the perhaps disreputable thing which Nike has acknowledged by withdrawing them is that to make money off that is perhaps one of the carnal sins, both in the public and as they're seen, but also in trying to defend themselves. There's not really much for defence, is there?
I mean, I even think in terms of even if you were putting on an exhibition about this pattern and about the cultural history, you've got to get the people to whom that belongs involved.
A serious lesson, but a deeply relevant one. Thank you so much, Katie Tregidden. Katie Tregidden is a design journalist, and thank you very much for being on the show.
My pleasure.
And lastly on the show, we have time for the second instalment of our Future of the Office series, and we turn to American firm Knoll for inspiration. Knoll have been making furniture for offices and homes for over 80 years and have collaborated with some of the biggest names in design and architecture, including a roll call of masters numbering Ludwig Mies van der Rohe, Frank Gehry and Eero Saarinen, just to name a few. Knoll's designs have changed the way that modern offices not only look, but also how they operate. Benjamin Pardo is design director for Knoll and met up with Monocle's Ben Rylan. Ben started by asking, what makes a good-looking office?
The people in it, right? So let's start with them, because it's about work. And Knoll is always about dealing with how do you put together an interior space and create a sub-architecture and an overall space and make that space work for the people to get done what they need to do and work within their corporate culture. So the objects, in some sense, are secondary players to what it is that takes place overall.
I think if a lot of people think about a functional office, mm-hmm. I mean, a functional office can also be very drab, right? We mm-hmm. always like to say that good design is functional, but you can walk into what maybe the office of a financial planner that's mm-hmm. really set up purely for function. Now, that might work okay, but the design aesthetic is not necessarily there. Where is the relationship between good design and good function when we talk about the workplace?
I think that there needs to be a balance between what we see, what we do, how we feel about it, how we're interacting with each other. And I guess I'll start with a basic tenet associated with what we think about at Knoll, is that we have a very Florence Knoll, Saarinen-based logic to the approach about how spaces and offices in particular, but also homes, should work. You start with architecture, and then Florence Knoll made big rectangles, things like sofas and credenzas, that helped physically divide space. And then Saarinen did very figurative things that were about background, foreground, and they sort of represented you in the space. And what they do is they set up circulation patterns for people to walk through, be in, relate to each other, and so on and so forth. Whether or not they express themselves in a very bright, vital textile, or whether or not they have incredible texture, or whether or not they are large or small, is really based on what the specifier or the architect or the person putting that office really needs and understands of the individual culture. The animation comes from the interaction of the people, as I said previously, and it is the objects that delight on occasion, right? A more Eamesian approach to something that's very product design that I spend time looking at, that's the delightful thing that I see, as opposed to the functional kind of thing, which is a surface and the simplicity of that object and the horizontals and the verticals. At the end of the day, what do we manipulate? We manipulate horizontal stuff and make it higher and lower, and we manipulate vertical stuff. Sometimes it's soft, sometimes it's hard, but those are the things that we do in our industry.
Take me into this idea of the mobile office. Mm-hmm. And I know that it almost sounds as if it's the opposite of what you would be catering towards mm-hmm. from your perspective. But needless to say, there is this idea now that everything is going to be mobile, mm-hmm. that workplaces being anchored to a desk is a thing of the past, and our personal space is going to be all encapsulated by an iPad or a laptop computer.
Well, your office is in your pocket, right?
Well, indeed. But mm-hmm. how does that impact the physical space then? Because it's not as if we're going to never leave our houses ever again. We still need somewhere to go, somewhere to do our work, somewhere in which to function. How does that impact your work as the designer of these spaces and the things?
I guess the real question goes back to some of the McKinsey comments that some of your prior guests made that dealt with the question of interactivity. Why do people go to the office? Do they go to the office to do heads down work on their own? Or do they go to their office to understand what's going on in terms of general corporate culture or the interaction with others in order to physically do something? And the teaming experience and so on and so forth. And the other question is that offices are not just 60-inch or 106-centimeter high boxes anymore. People don't always work at those headstand places. They're working either standing, seated, or on the floor. So there's also the question of mobility within a physical space itself and then outside of that physical space as well. And that change and move really has to do with the exchange of information on a device that we all keep in our pocket or goes on a desk or gets carried under our arm like a book. And that's the thing that frees you up. I take a logic that says the technology should really never be embedded in furniture, but rather is something that furniture needs to support in some way, because furniture gets developed over periods of 10 years in a leaf cycle, and technology changes on a regular basis a lot faster than furniture does.
Does that impact you in a practical sense? Do you find that, well, for example, if everything is becoming more mobile, does that also mean that the workplace is becoming less personal, that it's going to be less about us and more about just the function of people coming in and then going out?
No, quite the contrary. I think that there's also the next question that needs to be brought into it is generational, and the question of informality and what the expectations are in a work environment. So you have to pull all of those things together. And I guess the most important thing is that everyone always wants to move forward, but what is the culture of that company? What are they trying to achieve? What do they do? What are their services? How do they pull that back to their manufacturing or their thinking? So those things need to be represented in an overall interior space.
And how should we be moving forward then? If we're talking about designing the workplace of now, of the near future, what are the concerns that we should be thinking about now so that we can protect ourselves from designing ourselves out of comfort and designing ourselves out of the workplace?
There's a couple of ways to answer that question. I think that you need to design practically, and you need to design sustainably, and you need to design for the audience that is physically there. And the manipulation of those objects in order to achieve those things is what the specifier is best at doing.
That was Benjamin Pardo, Design Director of Knoll, speaking with Monocle's very own Ben Ryland. Thank you very much, Ben. Sadly, that's all we have time for on today's show, but don't forget, if you do need a little more design-minded inspiration, you can subscribe to this show and our sister podcast. You can tell your friends about it. You can send it to your parents. You can promote us in any way you deem fit. You could also, of course, pick up and buy a copy of Monocle magazine, which is available on all self-respecting newsstands now and available from monocle.com/shop. Monocle on Design was produced by Daphne Karnesis and edited by the saintly patient Christy Evans. I'm Josh Fennett. Thank you very much for listening, and goodbye.